All right, Erev Tov, everybody. Welcome to our weekly Parshat HaShavua Shir. We have Torah Moshe, a pleasure to welcome Rabbanit Leah Sarna, who, living in Philadelphia, is the Associate Director of Education, Director of High School Programs at Jerisha. Before that, she worked for 2 years, I don't know how many years, in Chicago. And Anshe Shalom B'nai Israel Congregation in Chicago. She's has smicha from Yeshivat Maharat, BA from Yale University in philosophy, and she is learned in Migdal Oz in Israel, Latrisha, and it's a pleasure to welcome her, and looking forward to learning the Parsha with you. Vakasha.
Thank you so much for having me, Rabbi Kalman. It's great to be ostensibly back in Toronto Zoom land, though I have to say I see a lot of people here from Newton, Massachusetts, which is my hometown. So nice to see you. and great that you're taking advantage of all that Torah Motion has to offer, even if it's ostensibly across the border and the borders are ostensibly closed. So today we're going to talk about the very, very end of Parshat Tetzaveh. And honestly, we're going to talk about some really boring things. That's the subject matter. The subject matter is boring stuff. It's the things that we do all day, every day. There's parts of Judaism that are as regular as breathing. Those are the things that we're going to be talking about. So in this week's Parsha, we learn about the Korban Tamid, which is the daily offerings. And it's basically the first thing that we learn about once the altar is kind of like fully set up and ready for business. So the Mizbeach is declared, the Hayah HaMizbeach Kodesh Kadashim. The Mizbeach was Holy of Holies. It's very high level of holiness. It's ready for operation. And then we get the following, which is source number one for those of you following along on the sheet from Shmot Chavtet. Now, this is what you're supposed to do with the Mizbeach. This is what you're supposed to do with the altar. Kvasim v'nei shana shnayim layom tamid. Two lambs, a year old, regularly tamid, each day. Et ha-keves ha-echad ta'asev ha-bulger. One lamb you shall offer in the morning. Bet ha-keves ha-sheni ta'asev ben ha-arbayim. And the other lamb you offer in the afternoon. And then you offer up some side dishes along with those lambs. So some flour stuff and some oil stuff and some wine. And here's the timing in which you're supposed to do it. Okay, so now I'm on verse 42, Membet. Ula tamid l'dorotichem, patach ohamoi lifnei Hashem. It is a regular burnt offering throughout your generations at the entrance of the tent of meeting before Hashem. Asher iva'id lachem shama l'daber ilacha sham, where I will meet with you to speak to you there. Veno adati, right? That same kind of word, vivaid, veno adati, shama livnei Yisrael, venikdash bichvudi. I will meet with the Israelites there, and it shall be sanctified by my glory. So it seems like there's maybe like a causal link between the meeting and the sanctification. First, no adati, shama livnei Yisrael, and then venikdash bichvudi. I will consecrate the tent of meeting and the altar, and Aaron also and his sons I will consecrate, and they're going to serve me. I will dwell amongst the Israelites. I will be their God. And they shall know that I am the Lord their God, who brought them out of the land of Egypt, that I might dwell among them. I am the Lord, their God. So the pshat reading of this very kind of repetitive last bit that I brought here, it seems to be Hashem will dwell in their midst. Then the Jews will know that Hashem took them out of Egypt so that Hashem could dwell in their midst. It's just like this two-step process of Hashem dwells, and once Hashem dwells, then the Jews understand that this was the point of the Exodus. But I want to put forward potentially a different reading, which is that when Hashem dwells in the midst of the Jewish people, in the midst of the camp, let's say, then they'll know that Hashem is their God. And that then in turn causes Hashem to dwell. So it's a circle. Hashem dwells, recognition, Hashem is here. And that then causes Hashem to continue to dwell or to stay there. And so what I want to propose based on that slightly different reading. So again, reading number one was God dwells in their midst. Then we understand that Hashem took us out of Egypt for this purpose. And read number two is actually more of like a three-step circular process of Hashem dwells in our midst. We'll know that Hashem is our God. And that knowledge actually then has another causal relationship back to Hashem dwelling. So the tzmidim, the daily sacrifices are these everyday functions. And I want to suggest that they offer like a maintenance role in our relationship with Hashem. So until the tzmidim start, there's no meeting. But that's kind of like the baseline. And then once all of that's functioning, then there's light and there's heat. And then the meeting can kind of really get going. The meeting can really take place. And meetings have to go both ways, right? If I'm in a meeting, but I can't see or hear or recognize that you're there. And even if you're there, but I can't see you, then we're not really having a meeting I feel like Zoom has really like solidified that fact, right? We're all like in the meeting, but if I can't see or hear or be seen and be heard, then like we're not really having an effective meeting, right? Like when someone's trying to talk, but they're on mute, then it's not an effective conversation, right? And so the meeting doesn't really happen until everyone kind of recognizes each other within the meeting. So if God dwells in our midst, and then we recognize that God is there, that then makes the meeting happen of Hashem dwelling in our midst. It enables Hashem to dwell with us. It enables us to be good, God-fearing, God-recognizing Jews, which then enables God to kind of dwell amongst the God-fearing Jews in this very like circular fashion. I'm here because you're here. You're here because I'm here. I'm here because you're here. And so on. And that is this very like baseline foundational relationship that gets established only once in our parsha. We have a mizbeach and we have a spot for that meeting to take place. Okay, so then the obvious question is, well, okay, that's very nice, but is the meeting over when sacrifices are no longer being offered? If the whole meeting is premised on these tzmidim, the daily sacrifices, then cool, those haven't been brought in a really long time. What happens now? So the Gemara is very attuned to this exact problem and says, no, the tzmidim live on. Now we're in source number two. And we have this classic debate that might very well be familiar to you. Itmar Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina Amar Tfilot Avot Tiknum. So Rabbi Yossi, son of Rabbi Chanina, says the Tfilot were instituted by the patriarchs, by the Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi Amar, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi says, no, Tfilot Keneged Tmidim Tiknum. The Tfilot, our daily prayers, are instituted to replace daily sacrifices. And then he goes on to learn halachot about when each of the daily prayers happens based on when the offerings in the temple happen. And the result of that is that it seems like, okay, there's a debate about kind of like who founded the tefillot, who founded the daily services, and when were they founded even. But at the end of the day, even if you are on camp tefillot avot tiknum, like even if you're in the camp of like, yes, like, Abraham invented Shacharit by getting up in the morning, and Yitzchak invented Mincha by going out to discuss in the field there's all sorts of, we could have another shiur about what Lasuach Masadah might mean, but anyways, right, like even if you're totally in camp, Tfilot were invented by the forefathers, all of the rules about when to say each one take all of their precedent from the tzmidim. So even if you're going to say, yes, tefillot were invented then, you still have to give some credence to the idea put forward by Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi that the tzmidim maybe give form to an idea implanted or begun by the patriarchs or something in that direction. And I want to say, though, that if daily sacrifices don't quite sort of do it for you as a source of this like ongoing relationship. There's other pieces to this ongoing relationship that could be maybe just like articulations of what the Tamid offerings are all about. And might be also articulations about what tefillah is all about. But when the Bir Halakha describes them, Bir Halakha is written as the same, is like the extended piece of the Mishnah Berurah. When he describes them, he talks about them a little bit differently than the way the Korban Tamid and the daily sacrifices were, the Korban Tamid and our daily prayers are, because those are like three moments throughout the day. They're not continuous. It's like, okay, I did this thing at this time every day, but it's not ongoing throughout the day 100%. And the Bir Halakha suggests that there's six perpetual mitzvot that are actually, they're on 100% of the time. So now we're in source three. And he says, Shish mitzvot chiyuvant midi lo yifsuku me'al ha'adam afil rega echad kol yamav. There are six commandments, and their obligation is perpetual, and they should never stop from a person, even for one moment in all of his days. Anytime that you contemplate, you meditate on these principles, you are fulfilling a positive commandment. And there is no end to that. To like the reward given to the people who work on these mitzvot, and these are they. So I'll just read down the list real quick. One, to believe that there is a God, lahamin sheyesh Eloh achad ba'olam. Two, shelo na'amin b'shum elohim zulato. We don't believe in any other God. Gimel liyachido, to believe in the unity of God and to declare that unity. Four, lahuv hamakom baruchu, to love God. Five, liot yirat Hashem al panav tamid, to fear God. And six, shalona turachar machshavot halev v'reiyat ha'inayim, to not be misled by our heart or our eyes. These are the principles put forward by the Bir Halakha as things that they're not only daily, these are every minute of every day, these are ongoing, perpetual, all of the time. I see that there are some like thoughts and questions going into the chat. I was instructed to do Q&A all the way at the end, so feel free to put ideas and thoughts into there, but I'm gonna look at it and then take questions, and we'll have some discussion once I've like finished the whole thing. So I meant to say that from the start, but I'll say that now as I see people putting things in. So anyways, so we now have these ideas of certain things that kind of like keep the lights on in our meeting between people and God. So originally that was, wow, now we have a mizbeach, now we have an altar, it's finally built, we have this opportunity to build the korban, to start doing the korban tamid. And what is the point of the korban tamid, says our parsha? The point of the korban tamid is that God will be there to meet me, I'll be there to meet him, and then God will be there to meet me again, this circular thing. And then how do I, okay, in a world without sacrifices, how do I replicate that? Three times a day, I show up to meet God, God shows up to meet me, I show up to meet God, God shows up to meet me. And this kind of sets that baseline meeting between people, or at least the Jewish people, and God every day. And the Bir Halakha says, I can do you one better. I can do all day, every day, all the time. And what the Bir Halakha puts forward is actually such a compelling kind of read for what it means to be in a constant meeting with God. Well, if the meeting is all about recognition of the presence of the other, that is a kind of a foundational piece of what it means to be in a meeting, is that I see you and you see me, and I can hear you and you can hear me, and we're in relationship because we're seeing each other and recognizing each other, then it's a pretty good start to know that the other person is there, to not confuse them with anyone else, to know some core features of them, like the fact that God is one, to be happy to be in that meeting. So maybe that I love God, and to like have the right dynamic. So it's somewhere between love and fear, both at the same time, suggests the Biur Halacha. And to not be drawn out of the meeting, to not be misled, velotaturu, to not be drawn astray by my heart and my eyes. Those are all things to like eliminate distractions, right? If you ever talk to someone who's like an expert in how to create environments like Priya Parker or people like that, like that's one of the things they always talk about is like, what's going to distract from the meeting, from the engagement, from the gathering. And to remove those distractions and make sure that you're not in a position of violating velotaturu. So all of these things kind of set up opportunities to meet God. So we're gonna transition now to two different understandings about why the tzmidim might be important. Why is it important actually to have this like regular meeting? Why is it important that we have a standing meeting with God? So we're going to look at two different thinkers. So one, we're going to look at the Maharal, and then we're going to look at a sicha given by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. Okay, so the first is, and we're in source number 4 now for people following along inside. Okay, so we're in the Maharal, and he quotes a beautiful collection, story type of thing. One iteration of it appears in the Sifra, but then it gets kind of like told over better in the Ein Yaakov. The Ein Yaakov is a collection of all the stories in Shas, but all the like Agadotas in Shas. But this one actually isn't in Shas, and the Ein Yaakov just tells it anyways. And the Maharal tells it, and then he says something about it. So we're gonna go through the story, but where I'm excited, the story is phenomenal, but it's another classic. But what I'm excited about is like where the Maharal takes it. Okay, so we have a midrash and the Sifra, and it says as follows: "V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha," you should love your neighbor as yourself. Rabbi Akiva says, "Ze kol gadol b'Torah," right? Rabbi Akiva says, loving your neighbor as yourself, this is a fundamental principle in the Torah. But then Ben Azai says, that's not the most fundamental principle in the Torah. I think the most fundamental principle in the Torah is Ze Sefer Toldot Adam. This is the book of generations of humanity. And it goes on from there to say that they were created in the image of God, and maybe that's what he's getting at. Anyways, fine. And then the Ein Yaakov, so that's what's in the Sifra, and then the Ein Yaakov expands on it. So the Ein Yaakov adds in a few more positions to this debate. The Ein Yaakov adds in the position of Ben Zoma, who says, I found an even bigger, even better klal gadol, an even more foundational principle, Pasuk Kolel Yoter, and what is it? Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. It is one of the perpetual mitzvot of the Biur Halacha. It is the unification of God's name. Hear, O Israel, Lord our God, the Lord is one. Then we have another opinion, Ben Nana Somer. No, I found one even more than that. And he goes back to Rabbi Akiva's original position of V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. And then Shimon Ben Pazi says, I want even more than that, and that is et hakeves ha'echad ta'aseh ba'boker, and that is bring the first sheep in the morning. It's one of our verses that we opened with today. Bring a sheep in the morning, bring a sheep in the afternoon. That is the korban tamid, and according to Shimon ben Pazi, that is the most foundational principle in the Torah. More foundational than man being created in the image of God. More foundational than God being our recognition that God is one, more foundational even than loving your neighbor as yourself. Rishon ben Pazi says, most foundational principle in the Torah is the Korban Tamid. And then Rabbi Ploni, an anonymous rabbi, gets up on his feet, Amar al Raglav, Ma'amar Halacha Kibed Pazi. He paskins. What is the most foundational principle in the Torah? It's what Ben Pazi says. It's the Korban Tamid. It's the most foundational principle in the Torah. So the Maharal goes on from there. My pages here. Oh, no, here we go. The Maharal goes on from there, and he says, what's this all about? So now I'm in the underlined part in the Maharal. Ratzalomar, ma sha'adam uvid ha'shamit barach b'tzmidut ha'gamor, b'hu avdo, means to say that the fact that a person serves God with this tzmidut ha'gamor, this total perpetuality, v'hu avdo, and he is God's servant, v'kamosha eved lo sar, avodato min ha'adon shelo, and just like a slave doesn't transition his like servitude away from his master, raku avdo tamid, he just serves his master all of the time. And that is the point of the korban tamid, of the perpetual, of the daily offerings, is that it establishes this perpetual, nonstop relationship between people and God. And that relationship is a master-slave relationship, says the Maharal. It establishes the master-slave relationship. And that is the foundation of the Jewish people's relationship with God, right? God took us out of Egypt, not to be free, but to serve God. And that foundational relationship that it's manifest as like perpetuality, and we symbolize it through the Korban Tamid, and that's why the Korban Tamid, according to Ben Pazi and Rabbi Ploni, is the most important mitzvah in the Torah. So if like slavery metaphors don't really do it for you, I wouldn't really blame you. And you don't have to buy it, because Rav Lichtenstein comes around and has a different read. He put this forward in 1997. In a sikha, and like a chat about the parsha that he gave in the yeshiva of Yeshiva Har Tzion, and it's called A Daily Sacrifice, A Great Principle in the Torah. So it's based on this midrash from the Ein Yaakov, and here's what Rav Lichtenstein said. This is like an English language summary from the Gush website. It was originally delivered in Hebrew. Other religions and belief systems focus almost entirely on spiritual peaks, on those exceptional bursts of upliftment, enlightenment, and elevation, on the once-a-year celebration. We too have our celebrations, our pinnacles, and peaks, but these are not the essence of our spiritual growth. Judaism focuses particularly on the everyday, the common, regular, mundane activities which comprise the bulk of our lives. We attempt to imbue these with meaning, requiring our growth to take place every day in small increments, right? So what Rav Lichtenstein's really pointing out here is that by prioritizing the keves ha'echad ta'asa b'boker, beta keves ha'sheni ta'asa ben harbayim, what we're saying is the daily offerings are more important than the, let's say, musaf offerings. They're more important than the offering we bring, you know, once a year on Shavuot, or the offerings, you know, all the pageantry of the Korban Pesach, or the many, many offerings of Sukkot. More important than any of those is the daily in and out. And why is that, says Rav Lichtenstein? It's because these are our lives. The daily in and out is actually what our life is. And so our job as Jews is to imbue life, all of these daily moments with meaning. And what that means is that we're never off the hook. It's not like, oh, leading up to this holiday, I'm going to celebrate. I'm going to improve myself. I'm going to something. No, like our growth and the foundation of our relationship and the backbone of Judaism is that actual everyday striving, everyday growth. It requires our growth to take place every day in small increments. I want to keep reading, because here's where he gets to the Korban Tamid specifically. The idea is simple. From the very beginning of the tabernacle's function and every day thereafter, a new foundation is laid. A foundation consisting of the most regular, the most plain daily sacrifice. In order to build any building, to create any framework, one needs to focus not on the one-time opening ceremony, but rather on the daily routine, the ordinary, gray, unnoticed things which form the framework's basis. It is these things which define the context and matrix in which all actions, all thoughts, and all other development take place. The most important thing is the framework. It's the matrix. That's where everything else can happen. You want to have a celebration? You better have a building to have your celebration in. We learn this idea from the tabernacle on a halachic level, as we saw in the Mishnah and Menachot, which you and I did not see together. Without the regular daily sacrifice, the tabernacle could not exist. However, this concept applies with greater strength to a greater and more difficult construction, that of human personalities. It is all too easy, he's speaking to a yeshiva audience, so he says to a yeshiva student, to grow accustomed to the daily regimen and lose focus of the opportunity for growth it offers us, when we focus instead on the high points of the year. Later, when one leaves yeshiva, one realizes the crucial importance of daily life, not just peak experiences. One's focus must be on the daily step-by-step growth and development. Every regular time we set for learning Torah, every regular mitzvah, every modeh ani, every blessing, every opportunity to give charity, every one of life's seemingly irrelevant moments can be used as a milestone on our way, as a way on our journey towards becoming better human beings and holier Jews. That you might think, oh, you know, the day-to-day just feeds into the background, and really what I look forward to or what I'm going to remember are the big milestone moments. But actually, especially when you're looking at a yeshiva context where you're going to live it for a short amount of time and then you're going to do something else with your life afterwards, you look back and you realize, wow, it was actually the day-to-day. It was like how I structured my life during that time. But I think where we can take Rav Lichtenstein's idea is to somewhere a little bit different, which is to say that that's then a push for all of us, even if we have a lot of stability in our lives. We're in jobs that we'll be in for the next 20 years, or we're, we know where we're living and we know what we like to do and we know how we like to do it. What it means when you think about it from the perspective that he's putting forward is that exactly within that stability, those basic kind of frameworks of our lives, we need to pay a lot of attention to what those frameworks are, because those frameworks are actually everything. And if those frameworks aren't pushing us towards daily growth in small increments, then maybe we have to fix the framework, because the framework is the most important thing, says Rav Lichtenstein, in the kind of daily functionality, not just of the Mishkan, which is the context in our parsha, but even more so of our own kind of foundational relationships with God. And so it's all about, actually, on a normal day, the most regular day of the week, the most regular week of the month, what am I doing on that day? That's what we're interested in. That's what the Korban Tamid and the value, the specific value of the Korban Tamid really can come and teach us, says Rav Lichtenstein. But I want to point out something, which is that Rav Lichtenstein opens up a really interesting possibility, which is like, how do you come to appreciate the moment? In the moment, like this regular thing, because regular things, we're programmed for regular things to kind of fade into the background. We're programmed for the things that we do every day, day in and day out, to just become normal and we forget about them, even if they're normal and they're pushing us towards growth. So you can think as a paradigm for this, think about a yeshiva schedule where I wake up in the morning and I daven shacharit, and then I sit and stay there and I learn a gemara, a rashi, a tosfot, a ran, a riff, a rush, whatever it is, right? Like, even if that's my normal day and all of the things in that day are pushing me towards learning more Torah and growing myself as a human being, and that somehow becomes the normal, which it does when you're in yeshiva, and you kind of lose track of like how precious your normal is, how beautiful it is. You lose the perspective on it, because it's your all day, every day. So how can you possibly have perspective on it? There's sort of two ways to gain perspective. One is the way that Rav Lichtenstein sort of mentioned, which is like, yeah, someday you're gonna leave. Right? He says, later, when one leaves yeshiva, one realizes the crucial importance of daily life. So what's that? Like, that's when the lights go out. You know, that's when that the foundational relationship of I come to meet God, God comes to meet me, I come to meet God, God comes to meet me is disrupted. Let's say the temple burns down and then we have to say, oh my God, how is God and humanity going to meet? Let's make sure that we have tefillot. Or you could leave yeshiva or something like that, or move, or any of the many, many things, right, that can disrupt our day to day. So that's like one version, and that's kind of like a trauma version that happens throughout our lives, obviously, but always kind of with some pain, even if our old regular was worse than the regular that we're pushing towards. Changing up the framework, that kind of basic matrix of our lives, is very painful and very difficult. But in like the schema of Jewish history, where why don't we have the Korban Tamid anymore? What happened to that basis of relationship that was keeping the lights on in the meeting place between the Jewish people and God? That's even a bigger scale trauma of destruction. So there's one model, right? The model of how do I appreciate what I have? Well, lose it, and then you'll appreciate what you had. But the other model is to have moments where you lift up the regular. So you say, yes, this regular ongoing thing, it's so important, and I'm going to find the time to invest in it and to appreciate it and to notice it again and to do the work towards gaining perspective on my regular once again. And I want to suggest that for the Korban Tamid, there was a way built into it for the Jewish people to do that. And that way is through a program, maybe, a system called Ma'amadot. So we're now in source 6. And the Ma'amadot are described in the Mishnayot of Masachet Ta'anit as follows. Now I'm going to let the text kind of speak for itself because I think it does a really good job of it, but I'll explain as we go. So Iluhena Ma'amadot, the following is an explanation of Ma'amadot. So we saw kind of the first, in our parsha, we have the first description of the daily sacrifices, but the daily sacrifices are described other times. One of them is in Bamidbar Chafchet, Numbers 28. And it's actually, that's the reading that we read on Rosh Chodesh, which we'll come back to Rosh Chodesh later. Right, so the verse says, Tzavet b'nei Yisrael v'amarta lehem et korbani lachmi. Command the children of Israel, say to them, my offering, my food. The Mishnah then says, V'chi he'ach korbano shel adam kariv v'hu eino omid al gabav. How can a person's sacrifice be offered and he's not present? So let's say a different kind of sacrifice, not the korban tamid, but a sacrifice, let's say, I bring my korban pesach, right? So I bring my korban pesach to the Beit HaMikdash and I'm there. It's my korban pesach, of course. I'm bringing it and I'm there for it to be brought and it represents me and I take it home afterwards and I eat it. Or let's say I'm bringing a sin offering or a guilt offering or something like that, or a gratitude offering, a korban toda, right? Like my offering is representative of me. That's like the whole point of bringing an offering. But here we have the entire Jewish people bringing an offering, but then like who's there to represent it? That's the question of the Mishnah. How can a person's sacrifice be offered and he's not present? How does the Korban Tamid even work? Asks the Mishnah. So it says the early prophets instituted 24 priestly watches called Mishmarot. So there's 24 shifts of Kohanim that would come and serve in the Beit HaMikdash. So it wouldn't be like when we think of Kohanim serving in the Beit HaMikdash, we shouldn't imagine every Kohen in the Beit HaMikdash all the time. No, the Kohanim had other stuff that they were doing throughout the year and communities that supported them. And then every so often throughout the year, they would come to the Beit HaMikdash for a week at a time to serve. So that's one piece of what the early prophets established. They established 24 shifts of Kohanim. And then Al Kol Mishmar U'Mishmar Haya Ma'amad. So corresponding to each shift of Kohanim, there was to each Mishmar of Kohanim, there was a Ma'amad of regular people who came with. Ko Mishmar Mishmar Haya Ma'amad. Okay. So in each of these 24 shifts, you now have regular Jews, Yisraelim, you have a shift of Levi'im, and you have a shift of Kohanim. So higia zman hamishmar, when it's time for a certain shift of kohanim to go up to Jerusalem, kohanim velevim olim liyushalayim, then the priests and the Levites would go up to Jerusalem. V'Yisrael sheba oto mishmar, and the Israelites of that mishmar, the ma'amad, mikansim la'areham, they actually, instead of going up to Jerusalem, they would gather actually in their own cities, the korin b'ma'asa b'reishi. And they would read Ma'aseh Bereishit. They would read the narrative of creation, which is a really fascinating choice. Why is it that they're getting together and they're reading the narrative of creation? Okay, and here's more about what they would do. And then we'll read it. We're going to look together. Source 7 is going to be Maimonides' commentary on these Mishnayot. So we'll get a chance to answer some of the like really interesting questions about what is even happening with these Ma'amadot. But here's the rest of the story. So the men of the Ma'amad would fast 4 days of the week from Monday to Thursday. And they wouldn't fast on Friday and on our Shabbat, so that they wouldn't go out from rest and delight to toil and fasting, because what can happen if you do that? Because then you could die, v'yamutu, if you fast on Sunday, apparently, or if they would fast on Sunday. The parallel Gemara here has some like redaction that suggests that maybe the reason they weren't fasting on Sunday was actually had to do with like Christianity, which is kind of interesting, but in any event, I can give you a citation for that if you're interested. That is in Tani 27b. That's where you can find that. Okay. So they're fasting Monday to Thursday. And what do they do? Biomar Hishon Breishit Vihirakia. So on Sunday, they read Breishit, they read in the beginning and let there be an expanse. So Genesis 1 through 8. And then it goes through all the Torah readings for all the different days. And then it talks about like who got, like how did the Aliyot work? Who got called up? So we're kind of towards the bottom there. Parsha Gdola, Korino to Bishnaim, Vaktana Biachid, Bishachri, Uvet Musaf. So a long section was read by two people, a short section is read by one person. And this was done at Shachri and at Musaf. Uvimincha, Nichnasim, Vakorin, Alpiem, Kekorin, at Hashma. This is also super interesting. At Mincha, they would gather and they would read that same section, but they would just recite it by heart, the way one recites the Shema. The Shema apparently is this like paradigmatic thing that people know by heart. But again, we have this kind of relationship. The Shema, first of all, is like reappeared again here. And then also maybe like a certain relationship between these like core texts about creation and the Shema itself, which we'll see something about that soon. But Erev Shabbat at Mincha, they wouldn't gather because they had to, you know, go get ready for Shabbos. So Erev Shabbat at Mincha, lo yunichnasim, nipnei kvod HaShabbat. So this is the picture that the Mishnah paints about what the Ma'amadot are and why. So the why is, what does it mean for the whole Jewish people to be bringing a sacrifice? When you bring a sacrifice, it has to represent somebody. So, let's designate 24 different ma'amadot, and they'll be part of this, like, team of people who are, like, in charge of the Beit HaMikdash that week. So you'll have, that team contains Kohanim, who are the ones who are bringing the sacrifices, and Levi'im, who are the ones who are guarding the gates and singing and, like, taking care of other things in the Mikdash, and they go up, and then but it also contains, like, this representative section of Jewish people called the Ma'amad, and they don't necessarily go to Jerusalem, and instead just the work of their kind of Kohen and Levi brothers is like representing them. They gather in a public place and they read about Breishit. So again, why are we reading about Breishit? So let's take a look at the Rambam's Pirush HaMishnah on these two Mishnayot. So he says, Hineni, but so we're in source seven. Hineni, but Erlacha Milashon Zach, Kinilat Mishmar, Kolelet, Kone Mishmar, Velivia, Vancheo Toma Amat. So he says, first of all, let's just make a note about words in the Mishnah, that when the Mishnah uses the word Mishmar, it actually means it's a shift of Kohanim, Levi'im, and the Ma'amad of the regular people. The Ke'ilo and Shei Ma'amad hem Shluchei Kol Yisrael, and it's as if the people of this Ma'amad, they're the messengers of all of Israel. Vahaita kavanatam umataratam, vahit askut ba'avodah v'tfilah, ve'inam oskim v'yiskei atzmam. And their intention and their purpose is to be kind of engaged in the worship and in the service, and they don't actually do their own work that week. And they're just directing all of their thoughts and all of their intentionality are going towards those daily offerings which are being brought on their behalf. Anyone who lived close to Jerusalem, so anyone who lived close, any people of the Ma'amad who lived close, would go up to Jerusalem, and they would actually, right? Because the question of the Mishnah is, how could a korban be brought and it not be representing anyone? Like, how? Why isn't anyone there to be represented by it? So the answer is, if they live close, they would go up and they would actually be there. And someone who is far away from Jerusalem, and anyone who's further away, they would gather in their synagogues in their own cities, and they would pray and they would read Torah as it was said. And they would engage in service that entire week, but not like the service of the Kohanim in the Beit HaMikdash. Rather, it's like their own more like tefillah-y kind of service of fasting, reading Torah, and praying. And they would read Maaseh Bereishit. Now it's the question of like, why creation? Korim b'Maaseh Bereishit. Because the perfection of existence is the service in the temple. And our services are the sacrifices. And that's why they say, without sacrifices, heaven and earth would not endure. So we read about creation because the pinnacle of creation, in a way, like the last thing created. I know the Mishnah has this whole list of things that were created like right before Shabbos as the sun was setting. But here the Rambam, and he's quoting Gemara, says the most, the last thing to be created actually were the sacrifices. And the sacrifices are this kind of completion of God's creation. And so while the sacrifices are being brought, we contemplate this like completed, perfect, beautiful creation through the reading of the creation story, through the reading of Genesis 1, which is a really cool idea, because all of a sudden what's happening is if what the Korban Tamid represents is this like ongoing relationship between people and God, and it kind of creates that framework, matrix, background for that relationship, then what that framework and matrix and background is like the pinnacle of creation, and it's essential to creation. It's as kind of background as the trees and the sky and the sea, which we all know all of those things are amazing. And if we stop to think about them, then they're amazing. But they also so easily sink into the background because they're permanent, or they experience them as permanent. And because they are kind of there all of the time, they're also part of this like tamid background baseline relationship is creation as well. And the sacrifices and that meeting point with God is maybe like the pinnacle, but it's still all part of the same kind of matrix foundation point. And then what we have as a description. So, right. So then we talked about, well, how are you supposed to recognize that foundation? How are you supposed to recognize that matrix in order to appreciate it? And Ravaran says, yeah, you recognize it once you leave. Well, I don't want to have to leave exactly in order to recognize it. So I think that the Mishmarot really offer this other model of how am I supposed to recognize it? Set aside time for recognizing it. Set aside time for recognizing that relationship. So what does that mean? How do I do that? So some of that will depend on you and what you like to do. But the same way that going on a hike can help remind us about how amazing and miraculous nature is, even though when I walk down the street in Philadelphia or in Newton or Toronto, I'm in a way surrounded by nature, but I kind of switch it up within the same, I don't have to go very far, right? To kind of switch it up, have a different experience, get a different perspective on it. And then all of a sudden, I appreciate it so much more because I saw, instead of this one tree that I see every day, I saw hundreds of trees as far as the eye could see. And now I'm like, wow, trees. And then I can go home and be like, this tree participates in the same tree thing that those guys did. And wow, trees are amazing. Or you could say, I daven 3 times a day, and that davening lays the foundation for my relationship with God in this super ongoing, perpetual way. But it loses its pizzazz, right? And when it loses its pizzazz, okay, I'm still doing it, but like, can I really appreciate it? Do I really experience it as this like little inching towards growth every single day? That's really hard. So maybe I mix it up on Shabbos when the davening is different. Maybe I mix it up on holidays when the davening is different. Or maybe I go to a different minyan. Or if I normally daven at home, I go to minyan. Or if I normally daven in one room of my house, I daven outside on my porch. Or I daven somewhere else. I mix it up a little bit in order to like reinvigorate that foundational framework. And I think that's very much the same thing that the Ma'amadot represents for the Korban Tamid. Yes, the Korban Tamid is ongoing, but every 24 weeks, I tap into it. I lift it up. I take 4 days off work and I gather with all the other people in my Ma'amad and we read the story of Bereishit and we remember that creation is being upheld and being completed and being celebrated by these like ongoing Korban Tamid offerings that are being brought in the temple on my behalf. And wow, I'm so grateful that the Korban Tamid sets up this moment and this space for a relationship between me and God that would not be possible otherwise. And while I'm on my Ma'amad, I get to spend 4 straight days just focusing on how amazing that is. And then I'm going to go back to my normal life, but I'm still going to remember for at least a little while that the Korban Tamid is ongoing and that it sets up this way for me to be in this constant relationship with God. And another way to do it is, so as I mentioned, that the Mishnayot in Masachet Tanit, they don't quote our verses about the Tamid offering. They quote these verses that we actually read on Rosh Chodesh, which makes sense because kind of immediately after, so you have in Bamidbar 28, you have the Korban Tamid, the daily offerings, then you have the Shabbat offerings, and then you have Rosh Chodesh. So that's that like three-part thing is the Torah reading on Rosh Chodesh. So it makes sense. Just you have to start somewhere, whatever. Torah reading on Rosh Chodesh is a whole complicated sugya and Gemara, but it kind of makes sense. But then there's this other piece to it of like, well, maybe it's actually more than that. Maybe on Rosh Chodesh, when I kind of do a weekday davening, but then I add in halal and I add in musaf, and it's kind of a normal day of the week and month, and I don't necessarily do anything special, but I kind of know it's Rosh Chodesh because I said halal and I daven musaf. And so maybe one option for how to build a ma'amad in our life would be also just to say that actually Rosh Chodesh is our ma'amad, is our little way of tapping into like, wow, I daven every day and this made my davening more interesting. And this reminded me of the Korban Tamid, but like an elevated Korban Tamid one day. And that's maybe what Rosh Chodesh could represent for us, is this like elevated Korban Tamid. And by Korban Tamid, I mean not only like the specifics of like this sacrifice or even the specifics of like my davening, but maybe just the fact that I have a standing meeting with God. and that God is present for me so that I'm present for him, so that God is present for me in the meeting that's described at the very outset of our parsha of Yiva'id lachem shama v'no'adati shama v'yad'u ki ani Hashem l'shochni v'tocham ani Hashem, that I will meet with them there, and I will meet them there, and then they'll know that I'm God, and then I will dwell amongst them. And that sets the model for what it means that God shows up for us, we show up for God, God shows up for us in all sorts of different kinds of manifestations, all day, every day, through constant mitzvot, through tefillah, but that also we have to invest in that foundational, basic kind of matrix that underlies our lives, that our lives lived in relationship with the Almighty, but that constant relationship needs every so often an extra boost of energy, get an engineer in to check the foundations, make sure they're still going really strong. And there's lots of ways to do that. I think the Ma'amadu would offer a really powerful model for how to do that, but maybe we can tap into the Ma'amadu on Rosh Chodesh, or maybe we can tap into it in the way that energizes each of us individually, but as a way to say, yes, I really value that daily, ongoing pinnacle of relationship and pinnacle of creation meeting that gets established in Shmot 29 towards the end of our parsha. Thank you so much for having me. I am going to take any questions or comments.
Thank you. You can take a look at the chat box, right? You see that?
I won't. Okay. So, yeah. Okay. There's some really interesting stuff happening here, right? There's an issue of going from a collective daily exercise to an individual one. And even once we say, well, like the ma'amadot are a way of making it like more individualized, but it's still something that you're doing in community. And there's something really wise about that, that actually like that relationship between me and God, or between God and the Jews and the Jews as a whole, is best manifested in relationship. So maybe that's davening with a minyan, is best manifested in community. So maybe that's davening with a minyan. Maybe that's, and this is obviously not a great idea in COVID, but once upon a time, there used to be activities that you could attend that would be these like massive gatherings of Jews, whether that's like Hakel coming up, right around Sukkot time this year, that is still kind of practiced, and you can go to the Kotel and massive, massive gatherings of Jews there, or like there used to be like Limud conferences that you could go to with lots and lots of people. And there's something so special about being somewhere with just lots and lots of people all at the same time. You even feel it like times when Shul is really full, like Yom Kippur. There's something different about, like, not just because it's Yom Kippur and it's amazing and it's the best day of the year, but also because it's full of the Jews and there's such a big gathering all together and there's something so special there. So I think, I don't know who iPad is, but I think iPad is definitely onto something with this idea that, yeah, like you shouldn't just think about this on an individual level. This needs to be a collective project. I think that's definitely right. Okay, wasn't the Korban Pesach also collective unless it was enough for only one person? Right, because you don't want to leave anything over from your Korban Pesach, so you need to gather a chavura. Sorry if I said otherwise. You're definitely correct. How did the early prophets select the Israelites? So I think it was by family, but then it was like, well, if you live somewhere different than your family, then you're still in the same ma'amad as your family was. So that's how you could get even like within one ma'amad, some people who are in Jerusalem and some people who are like in the north or whatever. Okay, we have a suggestion of a poem to read. That sounds cool. I look forward to reading that. Did the parity or gap between men and women stay the same, increase or decrease with the forced change from collective sacrifice to daily prayer? That is an interesting question. You know, I don't know whether women participated in the Ma'amadot or not. I've never thought about it before, which is surprising because I feel like I would have thought about it before right now. I don't know, Rabbi Kelman, do you have any ideas about that?
I also have not really thought about that. It doesn't appear that way, but listen, the entire Mishnah in Talmud is very male-centric. That's just the nature of society. So they didn't really, you just now, the Mishnah is very clear that women have to daven. That's, there's no distinction between men and women when it comes to tefillah. That's the Mishnah in Brachot. But in Tanit, I don't know. It's a
And
very
they're kind
interesting
of
question.
called like Anshei Ma'amad, but Anshei can just be the,
Correct. I
collective
mean,
name also.
Jonathan Sacks and other people have suggested that it's not really, many people have suggested the Ma'amad are really the beginnings of our Batei Knesiot. That as, the Ur Temple, they didn't really have shuls the way we have shuls. And the Ma'amadot was the transition coming together. The Mishnah uses those terms, from Knesset. I don't know. It's interesting. I can look maybe into many of the Farshim talk about it, but, I don't know.
Yeah, and then also like the
Okay. I mean,
directionality
there's
of
no
like
reason not
Hebrew.
to. There's no reason not to if it's part of tefillah, theoretically, but you somehow, I don't know. When I read the Mishnah, I don't get the impression there were women there, but who knows?
Right. Well, in the third Beit HaMikdash,
I find it fascinating, by the way, the Rambam. I was not aware of this Perush HaMishnayos on the Rambam here on the Ma'amadot. The Rambam talks so highly about Korbanot, where it's the same Rambam who has the pretty, not such high views of Korbanot. Korbanot is a concession to human weakness, and really God would prefer not Korbanot, but what can we do? Society couldn't tolerate this. I find that kind of interesting how the
But
Rambam.
it's you have to understand that Rambam wrote his Pirush Mishnayot in his 20s on the run in North Africa, right? And like what you're quoting is the Mishnah
Oh, it
is
also could
the
be he's explaining what the Mishnah means. It's not necessarily his personal
but
view,
also
but
he's
it's.
allowed to change over the next 40
No, of course.
years.
No, but I don't know. Is there any evidence? I don't know what the Rambam thought when he was younger. I mean, you're right. There are
Mean, this
lots
is
of.
the Rambam younger.
Right. No, I know, but I'm saying I don't know that he wrote clearly on the Korbanot when he was younger. In other words, he's explaining the Mishnah. Now, there are, listen, lots of people, there are contradictions between Perush HaMishnayos and the Mishnah Torah. And generally it's assumed the Mishnah Torah is more authoritative because he was older and he wrote it later and, et cetera, et
And in
cetera.
Hebrew, and it's like a halachic text, yeah, all sorts of things.
But I just found that in that struck me maybe. Okay. Anybody have any of the comments, questions? Vakasha? Okay, but thank you very much. Listen, I love your excitement. It's the excitement of youth, and but it's great when davening's
I'm
exciting.
already too old to have written
No.
Rambam's Pirush
Okay. Yeah, I mean, when I was in high school, they told me he wrote it at 17, but that's not true. I think he was in his 20s when he wrote it.
Funny.
But it's
Yeah.
still pretty impressive. I didn't write any Perush HaMishnayos and whatever, so it doesn't. Anyways, okay. Thank you very much. And
Thanks for having me.
tomorrow morning, of course, Maaser on the Seder. I'm actually tomorrow. I'm going to get to the Korbanot section. We just finished Mekadesh Shmoy Barabim. We have a little bit more to say there, and then we're going to get the Korbanot. So actually, it ties in very well. And I was thinking of talking. I'm planning, but I have a lot of other stuff to say. So I want at the Kavas of course, which we say every morning in our towards the beginning of Shacharit. So that's tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. Rabbi Liebtag is at 11:15 on Sunday, and Dr. Guhart's, Rabbi Guhart's on Islam on Monday morning at 11 p.m., and Dr. Shapiro on the Lies of Reform and Judicial Response, all our regular Shiurim, Aaron Kohler, Tuesday morning. I'm glad I was there. And then I mentioned Rachel Sharansky-Danziger is beginning a new series on Tuesday at 11 a.m. We'll have Aaron Kohler at 9:30. Rachel Danziger at 11 a.m., the ins and outs and liberty. And then, of course, Alex Israel at 1 p.m., a triple header back to back. By the way, and then Wednesday, we got lots to keep you busy. Let people in Philly know, lots of shearing going on. And, next Thursday night, Parsha Shear will be given by Rabbi Mordechai Turchiner, who, of course, is the head of the Zichron Dov Beit Midrash, here in Toronto. And, used to live in Pennsylvania and was the rabbi in Allentown, Pennsylvania. So before he came to Toronto for a number of years. So that's where he's coming from. He's not from Allentown, but he was the rabbi there. Anyways, okay, we look forward to learning with everybody. As always, please invite a friend and hope to see you soon. And Laila Tov, everybody. Shavuot Shalom. Be well. We hope to see you soon. Shavuot Shalom.